Making the homeless whole again. From treatment for medical, dental, and mental health issues to vocational training to child care and housing placement, Chapman Partnership guides the homeless from hopelessness to self-sufficiency, having served over 90,000 people with a success rate upwards of 62%. You can help the homeless with your support for Chapman Partnership. Details at 877-548-6369 or chapmanpartnership.org.
And we return on this Monday afternoon. It's Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on today's Topical Currents. Good afternoon, Bonnie.
Good afternoon. Good to be back. Had a successful pledge drive.
Well, good. And you were a big part of that.
Well, a lot of people were, and we thank everybody for their support.
Indeed we do. Well, today's guest is Temple University Professor Dr. Joan Mellon. Her latest book is Our Man in Haiti, George de Morenschild, and the CIA in the Nightmare Republic. This story goes back to the 1950s with Papa Doc Duvalier, Fidel Castro, and even includes Lee Harvey Oswald. Joan Mellon joins us from station WWFM in West Windsor, New Jersey. Welcome to you, Joan Mellon.
Thank you.
So George de Morenschild, tell us about the enigma, his background. He was a Texas petroleum geologist.
Well, George de Morenschild was actually born in Russia. His family left at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution and went to Poland, and eventually George de Morenschild came to the United States in 1938 by himself. By 1957, he was working for CIA in the International Cooperation Administration, which is something like what they call AID today. It was a CIA front. And along the way, CIA enlisted George de Morenschild to keep tabs, this is his words, keep tabs on Lee Harvey Oswald, who had returned from the Soviet Union and was living in Dallas and also in Fort Worth. And so de Morenschild took Oswald under his wing, took him to parties, introduced him to people, and really kept a watch on him. And it was very dangerous for de Morenschild to do this, as it turned out later, because what it meant after the assassination of President Kennedy, that CIA had knowledge of Oswald before the assassination, something that they have not admitted to this day.
The name de Morenschild sort of implies aristocracy in Russia, and Lee Oswald was sort of a kind of a deadbeat guy.
Absolutely.
An odd relationship.
It is, because actually the name originally was von Morenschild, which keeps the aristocratic background. And it was most unlikely for de Morenschild to have had anything to do with Oswald, which everybody would know, except for the fact that it was an assignment from CIA to do so.
And why was he given that assignment? I mean, why were they going to keep tabs on Lee Harvey Oswald? Because he had come back from the USSR?
No, well, I have to tell you, this goes back to another book that I wrote called A Farewell to Justice, which is about the Kennedy assassination itself. It's pretty clear that Oswald was being readied to be framed for the Kennedy assassination. There's no other explanation for any of this. And so the assassination was planned well in advance. CIA had something to do with it, and Oswald was being watched, being monitored, and of course, ultimately being set up and framed. That's another topic. We didn't think we were going to talk about that. We didn't think we were going to do the Kennedy assassination. Of course, when you say de Morenschild and Oswald, you say Kennedy assassination.
Right, right.
And so the Kennedy assassination occurs while George de Morenschild is in Haiti. After, in April 1963, Oswald goes to spend the summer in New Orleans. George de Morenschild has another assignment, and his charge this time is a Haitian banker named Clamar Joseph Charles. And Charles wants CIA and the U.S. military to invade Haiti, get rid of Papa Doc, and make Charles himself president of the Republic of Haiti. And so the story is about that intrigue.
Can we go back and do some Haitian history here and look at, you know, from the time of Toussaint Louverture to Papa Doc Duvalier and
Absolutely.
The CIA involvement?
Well, so of course, CIA didn't exist now, you have to remember, until 1947.
Right.
But what happened in Haiti, Haiti did something terrible. They abolished slavery 50 years before the United States did. And so this was something very annoying to the, you know, at the time. This was in 1804 now that Haiti declared itself free, got rid of the French, and the slaves revolted, and they took over the country as a republic. Well, they weren't going to get any help in the hemisphere, certainly not from the United States, which still practiced slavery. And so Haiti has been the stepchild of the Caribbean ever since. And Haiti is someplace to exploit, someplace to get money from, to cheap labor, American businesses, among many Texans doing business in Haiti, but not to help the infrastructure of Haiti. Haiti has not gotten anything out of that. And so it's a very, very sad story. Eventually, up to 1915, we find Woodrow Wilson using as an excuse, there was a certain turmoil in Haiti, uses as an excuse, he sends the U.S. Marines to Haiti, and they don't leave until 1935. So the American military presence is there. By the time this story occurs, American business is doing very well in Haiti, and the United States likes Duvalier because he protected American business. He didn't confiscate the way, he's the non-Castro. The alternative to Fidel Castro, who, of course, confiscated all American businesses in Cuba, everything. And here's Haiti furthering, and of course, Papa Doc is taking his cut, sending the money out of the country, drugs, arms, everything that you could think of, that's awful. But American business is doing very well in Haiti.
Go ahead, please. Finish your thought.
You go ahead, because it's okay.
Going back to François Duvalier, he was a simple country doctor. How was it that he was able to get to such absolute power?
Well, we had one corrupt president after another. So Papa Doc looked good. And, he got elected. And then he abolished elections, became the president for life, created terrorism, created a group called Tonton Macoute, which really inflicted terror on the poor Haitian people. Nobody, no dissent, no freedom, no nothing, and bled the people and bled Haiti dry. So it's just Haiti has stayed poor really all through these decades and decades. And I think we see it even after the earthquake today. Has Haiti really been helped? Has there been housing? Have there been businesses that support the Haitian infrastructure? No. Outsiders coming in, taking from Haiti, giving very little. Nothing really has changed, despite the enormous amount of money that seems to have been raised. And the United Nations has a group there that really, keeps order in Haiti. My book ends with two WikiLeaks. You know, God bless Private Manning, because he shows us how the State Department was thinking and how everything that was good for American business, therefore, anything that is not supporting American business, they're against. It's pretty clear. Their motives are just the same as they've been throughout the whole 20th century and now into the 21st.
When did the CIA get involved in Haiti?
That's a good question. CIA's everywhere, of course. As Ron Paul, by the way, in one of his speeches in the last few years, gave a speech in which he said he, along with President Truman, many figures in American history, have been for abolishing CIA because they're, again, they're really out there to make war, to create preemptive wars in order to support all the companies that make money out of war. So and they're especially in favor of wars of duration. CIA, in this story that I'm giving you, enters Haiti in the early 1960s when CIA joins with the military and is considering whether to make Clamart Joseph Charles president of Haiti, and whether they could get, you see, this is after the Bay of Pigs. And so they're very careful, and President Kennedy was very careful, that whatever America does in foreign countries and in the Caribbean, it not be seen. It has to be invisible. And it's extremely invisible. It's very hard, rather, to be invisible when you're invading another country. So we get these paramilitary operations to destabilize the regime in Haiti, rather than to all out get rid of Papa Doc, which was not easy because he was well protected, and that he shared with Fidel Castro. It's not easy to get rid of Papa Doc. And Clamart Joseph Charles, I should say, worked for Papa Doc. His bank was helped by Papa Doc. He was Papa Doc's bagman in the United States, paying American politicians to support policies that Haiti liked. And he also took care of Papa Doc's money and took it to Europe and took it out of Europe and all the bank accounts and helped in the drug business and the casino business and so forth. So he's playing a double game, hoping that Papa, eventually, as the story goes on, we Papa Doc realizes it. And Clamart Joseph Charles was about to go leave for the United States to make one of his appeals to get rid of Papa Doc. He was going to go to talk to Lyndon Johnson then. And Papa Doc finds out about it, and Clamart Joseph Charles is stopped at the airport. And he says, I have to go to the United States to have my tonsils taken out. And Papa Doc, he's taken to the palace, and Papa Doc says, we have doctors in Haiti. And they slam Charles into a hospital. And at that point, I have a marvelous figure in this book whose name is Joseph Dreyer, Joseph F. Dreyer, mm-hmm. Jr., who runs, he's growing Kenaf. Kenaf was an alternative to jute, like makes rope and burlap sacks and so forth. And that business was controlled by India and Pakistan. So why not grow jute in the Western Hemisphere? So here was Dreyer, first in Cuba, and then with Fidel Castro coming in, he comes to Haiti. And he's partners with Clamart Joseph Charles on a sisal plantation. And so he was a great witness for me in all, through all of these events. Eventually, Papa Doc, the two Tonton Macoutes get after Dreyer, and he had to leave. Very much a kind of story that you'd find in a novel by Graham Greene. And the title, I hope that the title is meant to be sympathetic to the people of Haiti. When it says Nightmare Republic, that's a phrase that was used by Graham Greene in his novel, The Comedians. And it means how much suffering the Haitian people felt under the regime of François Duvalier. And so I just thought that it would be amusing, anyway, to me, to have two. The title has two Graham Greene references. Our Man in Haiti, of course, is from Our Man in Havana. Mm-hmm. And the Nightmare Republic is what Graham Greene saw during the Duvalier regime when he was in Haiti.
We're speaking with Joan Mellon. Her latest book is Our Man in Haiti on today's Topical Currents. We need to take a short break. Please stay with us, and we'll return shortly.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. Vizcaya Museum and Gardens presents a special holiday evening Wednesday, December 19th from 6 to 9:30 p.m. You can experience Vizcaya decorated as its creator, James Deering, might have done. You can enjoy traditional holiday music played on Vizcaya's historic pipe organ, along with a book signing with pastry chef Hedy Goldsmith in the cafe and shop. Details at vizcaya.org.
Palm Beach Opera kicks off its 2013 season with Verdi's La Traviata, January 18th through the 20th at the Kravis Center in West Palm Beach. With passionate music and memorable melodies, La Traviata is one of the most popular operas ever composed. This production features an international cast, directed by opera legend Renata Scotto. More information and tickets are available at pbopera.org. That's pbopera.org.
Like Topical Currents' Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman, and we're joined by Professor Dr. Joan Mellon. Her latest book is called Our Man in Haiti. And as mentioned earlier, we will have a link to her book on the Topical Currents Facebook page as well. Tell me, Joan Mellon, more about Dr. Morenschildt and before the Haitian business, his Nazi tendencies.
Well, people accused de Morenschildt of being a Nazi, of being a Bolshevik. And it was because one of the things, he was a man for sale. He was a man for whom any intelligence service could bid. He was not a Nazi. He was not a Bolshevik. He was a man who didn't believe in anything. This is just the kind of CIA asset that they like. They don't want anybody with strong views who cares about anything. He did whatever he was told. And so de Morenschildt liked to shock people by saying, Hitler isn't so bad, the people are eating enough, and all kinds of remarks like this. And it didn't mean anything at all. I think that it's almost hard to find in literature a character who believes in nothing But this is just the person. And some at times he was very useful for CIA. He was useful even to the end of his life, because at the end of his life, de Morenschild started to say that the oil man, H.L. Hunt, was responsible for the Kennedy assassination. He had nothing to do with the Kennedy assassination, but what George de Morenschild was doing was winking to his CIA former employers, saying, see, I'm getting you off the hook. I'm creating another false sponsor. I'm supporting a false sponsor. And one of the things, that we're getting back to the Kennedy assassination, but one of the things that was done to in order to obfuscate, and that is to present many false sponsors. It was the mafia, it was the oil men, it was the French, it was the Russians, in order to make it so, just to create such smoke and such, I don't know what, the confusion. That you just give up and say, well, we're never going to find out the truth about that. And de Morenschild participated in that. It didn't do him any good because CIA cut him loose. So he had made a contract with Papa Doc that he was going to do supposed oil exploration and make a holding company. He never actually worked very hard in Haiti. And at the end, Papa Doc didn't really like having him around, didn't want anybody, any of this Kennedy assassination stuff around. And they gave him nothing. He left penniless. And went back to Texas.
If you'd like to join in the conversation, we're speaking with Joan Mellon. The book is Our Man in Haiti, George de Morenschild and the CIA in the Nightmare Republic. The number to call, 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN, or you can email radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. Compelled you to write this book? I mean, George de Morenschild is not a household name to most of us. What compelled you to write this book?
That's a good question, Bonnie. Well, the book is really, and for me, the important part of this book is the inner workings of CIA, how CIA operated, how CIA created assets, used contacts, involved itself in foreign countries, trying to manipulate the governments of other countries, supported defense contractors and American businesses, and really was making the decisions. That the military takes second place. And the sets of documents that I use for this book, many CIA documents, but also documents of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, which has a nickname even. It's called 90 Deuce. And that interested me as much. I was going to write a book about Texas and CIA. And de Morenschild was going to be one chapter. And the story got so big and so complex, and it had so many details and intrigues and interesting characters. I have the head of the French clandestine services in a chapter, because his main contact, his informant in the Caribbean, was a woman named Jacqueline Lancelot, who got to know Charles and de Morenschild and Joseph Dreyer, and she had a restaurant called Le Picardie. And I found out that when CIA people went to Haiti, before they even checked in at the American embassy, they went to Le Picardie. So I was able to, and Philippe de Vaujoly, who was this for the head of the French clandestine services, turns out to be the hero of a book called Topaz that Alfred Hitchcock made a movie of. So, and I learned a lot of interesting things. One was that Leon Uris, supposedly the author of Topaz, was actually the ghostwriter.
Oh.
And it's very hard, you know, odd for a best-selling author like yours, he wrote Exodus, to actually be a ghostwriter. And of course, he made a deal with de Vaujoly to tell his story. And then he didn't want to pay the royalties back to de Vaujoly, who sued him in a California court and won several hundred thousand dollars on that. That's just a side note. But Jacqueline Lancelot was so interesting because she was at the heart of espionage in Haiti. She had contacts in the Duvalier regime. She told Dreyer, You wait and see. When the Warren Report comes out, de Morenschild will be all over it. And, of course, it turns out that he was. So the whole history of the 60s comes through looking at Haiti.
In the mid-1960s, what influenced the CIA to want to be rid of Papa Doc?
Well, you know, we notice that they didn't quite get rid of him, did they? They didn't get rid of Duvalier.
Well, he passed it on to his son, right?
True. And they didn't get rid of Castro either, because they had other fish to fry. Haiti and Cuba, they were too small for what CIA wanted, a big, long war that they could make a lot of money out of, and they got that in Vietnam. So the focus really was switching to Vietnam, even at this point. And so we see Papa Doc escapes, CIA gives up, they cut Clamar Joseph Charles loose. They don't, they'll make, you know, they could deal with Baby Doc and Papa Doc and all of that. And they could even deal with Fidel Castro. That's because in their propaganda, they say, oh, we're going to get rid of, we can't stand Fidel Castro, we're going to get rid of him and so forth. And it wasn't the case at all. They sabotaged, that's my next book, which is about Cuba. They sabotaged their own efforts. Now, there were some paramilitary expeditions that went into Haiti in the late 1960s, 67 and 68, but really they came to nothing. CIA financed them, and yet there were not enough resources were not put into it to make any kind of impact.
So does the CIA always have these nefarious reasons for doing what they do? Are their motives ever well-intended?
I don't think so. I really don't. And I mean, if we look at Vietnam, which came after, I mean, I think that in Alfred McCoy's book about torture, he shows that CIA by itself was responsible for the deaths of 20,000 Vietnamese. Thrown out of the airplanes, they did their mind control games. And as George Orwell wrote somewhere, I don't think it was in 1984, but somewhere, the key about a war is not, the victory means nothing. What counts is how long it lasts. And we'll look at the length of the Vietnam War.
Touch
and all
on,
the protests. Yeah, sorry, we're getting off the topic.
Well, touch on the relationship between JFK and the tension with the CIA, particularly after the Bay of Pigs, and how that could have played a part in the assassination.
Well, that's real. Have you read A Farewell to Justice? It sounds like you did.
Yeah.
Because I devote quite a bit of time in that book to Kennedy's war with the CIA, and many people have noted it. Richard Reeves, in his biography of President Kennedy, quotes President Kennedy as saying, "Those CIA bastards, I'll get rid of them if it's the last thing that I do." And what bothered President Kennedy, and he was quite right, was CIA was making policy. CIA was assassinating people without telling President Kennedy. Kennedy was not responsible for the assassination of Diem in Vietnam, and that was a CIA operation. And he was furious because, in fact, the CIA armed Trujillo's assassins without telling President Kennedy that they were doing that, on and on and on. And it was Kennedy then tried to take away some of their powers, cut their budget, take away their U-2 program. There were several things that Kennedy did to try to slow the CIA down, and I think we see the result. I think that's really the truth about the Kennedy assassination.
Was there any effect in Haiti concerning the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis? Did
that's
it figure at all?
No. You see, what the United States was wanting from Haiti was that they vote with the United States in various meetings and of the Organization of American States and conferences to denounce Cuba, to and get everybody else in Latin America on board. That's what. So Haiti was to serve a useful purpose, and in exchange for that, the United States sent millions and millions of dollars into Haiti to build a new airport, and of course money that went into Papa Doc's pocket. But eventually, Papa Doc was too erratic, and he stopped supporting U.S., and he started collecting arms, and he sent Clamar Joseph Charles, for one, to the United States to get airplanes, to get boats, to get ammunition, and that they were going to defend. He was just out of control. And when that happened, the United States increased its paramilitary missions into Haiti.
How did you gain access to this previously classified information, and why was it made public?
That's a good question, Bonnie. But you know, if you under the JFK Act, which was passed in 1992, you would think that what was going to be released by the FBI, CIA, and other organizations would be material on the Kennedy assassination. But actually, it was a very wide net, and all sorts of information was released sort of peripheral to the Kennedy assassination. Material about Cuba, material about Haiti, material about everything. And if you go to the National Archives, you can find it. It's there. I think very few reporters go, and except for a happy few, because they don't want to know what they're going to find out. Because these documents, sooner or later, reveal what's really going on behind the scenes in government, and it's not what you read in the newspapers, and it's something. There's another whole government within the government. And I should, you know, say President Truman wrote an op-ed piece in the Washington Post, well-known a month after the Kennedy assassination, in which he accused the CIA of running a shadow government. and making policy, same thing that President Kennedy went on to say. President Eisenhower's warning about a military-industrial complex should have added the word intelligence in it. What people also don't necessarily know is that military is taking orders from CIA. It's not the other way around. And we can see this in a figure like Edward Lansdale, who's important, the Quiet American, is very important in the Vietnam period, that Lansdale's promotion to brigadier general was ordered by Alan Dulles, the director of Central Intelligence. And he told the military, I want this man promoted, and he was promoted. They didn't even know. I think Curtis LeMay was in charge. They didn't even know Lansdale particularly. Lansdale had been a CIA person under military cover. And what we see, you know, one of the things I wanted to reveal is how CIA operates, how they use businesses for cover, how they use the military for cover, how they use the church for cover, and how ubiquitous they are everywhere in the world. We don't seem, and they preferred all during these years not to be noticed, that we not know about them. And people who were in CIA and wanted to write about them, well, those books have to be read by CIA, and they're heavily redacted and censored. Since I was never a member of CIA, I wrote whatever I found in the National Archives. And I think that the people, there were so many documents, there's so much, nobody could really sit there and read them through and figure out which ones should we allow them, which ones should we destroy, which ones shouldn't we. And so we get an enormous amount of material. And a lot of the material I use for Our Man in Haiti also comes from the 902nd military group. And they're tracking Charles, they're tracking de Morenchil. And we have reports, CIA reports, where CIA was, they had a particular spy on de Morenchil in Haiti, and he attended all de Morenchil's dinner parties. We get the guest list, we get the conversation. One of the people who showed up at de Morenchil's dinner parties was Mohamed Fayed, whose name I think you will know as the father of Dodi, the one who died with Princess Diana and right. later, you know, went on to own Harrod's department store. This man, as a young man, he appears at de Morenchil's dinner table. Duvalier loves him. He takes the business for Port-au-Prince shipping business, hands it over to Fayed. Fayed then steals money, embezzles. Finally, Papa Doc finds out. And by that time, and what he did was, Papa Doc said to Fayed, I need $30,000 in cash. And at that point, Fayed knew the jig was up, and he went to the airport and left Haiti. It's sort of a little side note.
Yeah, you have a lot of them.
We're speaking with Temple University professor Dr. Joan Mellon. Her latest book is Our Man in Haiti. And we're going to take a short break and be back with more.
Back to Topical Currents in just a moment here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. NPR for the Florida Keys is 91.5 WKWM, and we're streaming online at WLRN.org. The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is often described as the engine that drives Israel's high-tech economy. Technion graduates help develop the Iron Dome defense system and many other life-saving technologies. Learn more at ats.org.
A Salute to Vienna returns to the Coral Springs Center for the Arts December 31st at 8 p.m. Hungarian maestro András Deák debuts with the Strauss Symphony of America and a brand new program. The new cast of European singers and dancers celebrate and inspire with Strauss waltzes, polkas, and operetta excerpts. A Salute to Vienna, December 31st at 8 p.m. Tickets at the Coral Springs Center for the Arts box office at 954-344-5990 or at coralspringscenterforthearts.com.
I'm John Labonia, General Manager of WLRN. I would like to thank the nearly 4,000 people, including 1,250 new sustaining members, who supported WLRN during our winter fund drive. Your contributions help make this the best radio station in South Florida. If you didn't have a chance to give, you can still do so at WLRNradio.org. Your end-of-the-year tax-deductible gift will help us pay for the news and entertainment programs you count on in the months to come.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman, and we resume our conversation with Joan Mellon, whose latest book is Our Man in Haiti. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you're certainly welcome. We have lines open, 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. And also we'll take any emails. That's radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. And we'll take a quick call. This is Paula. She's in Dania. Hello, Paula.
Oh, hi. Yes. Hi. As an old spy buff, I know everything your guest is saying is true. And my question is, what can help Haiti now? What can help them recapture power from the few Haitian families in power, from the so-called NGOs, so that they can survive and rule their own lives?
That's a great question, Paula. I think the first thing, get the United Nations out of there and get the CIA out of there. And the money that, have somebody administering this money who's Haitian in Haiti, some humanitarian organizations, and do the building and the that has to be done. But as long as you have the United Nations and the United States ruling it, nothing is going to happen. I mean, one of the groups in the New York Times reported that was building a clothing factory in northern Haiti turns out to have been in some country, Peru, I think, in South America, and exploited the people there, terrible strikes, and then goes to Haiti. And some, I think they were Korean in origin. And I think what you need is Haitian people doing Haitian business and the money staying in Haiti.
Dr. Mellon, how about giving us the details on George Bush's senior role?
Well, Joseph, that's a great question also, because George Bush, the CHW, when he was nominated during the period of the Church Committee, when CIA's assassination programs were being exposed, President Ford made George H.W. Bush the director of Central Intelligence. And during his confirmation hearings, Bush swore up and down that he had never had any association with CIA prior to that. Yet the story of Haiti shows, here's George H.W. Bush with his partner, Thomas Devine, and they're doing some kind of business in Haiti that's hush-hush. They're traveling to Vietnam as well. And, I mean, George Bush has been really involved, and I think I discuss as much of it as I can in this book. George Bush was involved with CIA right from the get-go. And also, of course, as we know, this is well-known, was debriefed by J. Edgar Hoover right after the Kennedy. Well, why would you debrief George H.W. Bush? Well, what Hoover did, Hoover was annoyed, and he outed Bush in a document, and he said that the FBI debriefed George Bush of the CIA, which is something you're not supposed to do because he was undercover in CIA all those years. And then he becomes president of the United States, so we can see the interchangeability. And CIA, when he talks about us, interchangeably, United States and CIA are synonyms. And here's an example of it. Long career in CIA, and it just turns out, in addition to all of that, that George Bush was when he was a boy at Phillips Academy in Andover, his roommate was George Demornschild's step-nephew. That's his brother's wife's son.
We have an emailer here who says that the author's view of this is very simplistic and that the Cold War was much more subtle and complex than what you portray. How would you respond to that?
Well, I would argue that the Cold War was a pretext furthered to a large extent by people like Alan Dulles to increase arms in the build up in the United States. That the Soviet Union had no intentions of invading the United States or anything like this, and that it was all a pretext. When the pretext of Russia no longer existed, look at this, in the 1990s, the communism falls, and what do we have to find another pretext? Haven't we found one? I'd argue that this war on terrorism, so-called, is an alternative to the war against the Soviets. They look very similar to me. Hmm. And I don't know if you want to say this is complex, that's not complex, this is simplistic. But I think if you say things in a clear way, they sound simplistic. That's the only I would say. I remember when I did a book about Coach Bob Knight, who's a basketball coach then at Indiana University, and I listened to him describe the plays, and I listened to a friend of his named Pete Newell, if anybody knows anything about basketball here, and Bob Knight was, I, who was not a basketball player, could understand every word. It sounded simple, but it really wasn't simple. It was just clear.
We have an emailer, Professor Mellon, from Lindsay in Boca Raton. Regarding the CIA, what evidence is there showing the CIA is a money-generating operation for its own sake?
Well, when you look at the CIA's use of covers, you find that most American corporations are accepting CIA people under their wing. That there's an inextricable relationship between CIA and business. Oh, much has been written about this. I quoted, well, and this is actually, I'm talking now about my next book, which is about Cuba, and I quote a Wall Street Journal article about how some of the business executives, such as with International Harvester and companies like this, were really chafing, didn't want to have CIA people on their payroll, and yet they had to do it. And I just want to add that in the Our Man in Haiti, there's an addendum about the H.L. Hunt and his sons. And people have often said, the oil men and so forth, the Hunts, that is H.L. Hunt and his sons, Bunker Hunt and all, they refused to let CIA use their businesses, oil businesses in other countries, particularly in Libya, for cover. And as a result, CIA engineered a propaganda campaign to blame H.L. Hunt for the Kennedy assassination.
And we'll move. Go ahead. We'll move along to some other callers. I got this is Gabriel. He's in Miami Gardens. Hi there.
Oh, hello. Hello, sir. It's good to be on Topical Currents. I listen sometimes when I get the opportunity. For Professor Mellon, I wanted to know if during your studies you came across any information regarding COINTELPRO and its operations in dealing with Malcolm X, even any surveillance that may have happened overseas while Malcolm X was traveling?
Excellent. I don't have the information. I'm sure they surveyed. I'm sure Malcolm X couldn't turn around without being followed by CIA. But it's very interesting because here's CIA turning against George de Moorenschild in this book about Haiti. And what happened was that the counterintelligence of CIA opened every single letter that was sent to George de Moorenschild while he was in Haiti, and then had the FBI investigate all the people who wrote to him. All of them, in fact, had nothing to do with anything. They were not spies it just shows the reach that programs like COINTELPRO had, because it's the same thing, really. They're not supposed to read our mail, and they're not supposed to read George de Moorenschild's mail, even if he was once their asset. And it really shows us the tip of the iceberg. But I mean, the COINTELPRO in New York City was very strong, and during the years of the protests against the war in Vietnam, I was included.
Wow.
Oh, wow. Really?
Well, yeah, because you see, if you ask the FBI, they have to give you the file that they made. I'm not saying I had the biggest file, but I asked the FBI for my file and for those years, and there it was. You went to this demonstration, and of course, a lot of it is guilt by association. People that you knew, or that's a crime, that you knew so-and-so and so-and-so.
So why did the CIA turn against de Moorenschild?
Because he knew too much. You see, he knew that CIA had their eye on Oswald long before the Kennedy assassination, and he was part of that. And now here he is, and he's testifying before the Warren Commission, and he's liable to tell. Now, he never did tell. He never did tell, except at the very last day of his life, practically, when he was talking to a writer for Reader's Digest. And then he said that CIA sent him, I quoted that earlier, to keep tabs on Oswald. But up until that time, he never really said a word. And he was really upset with them because they abandoned him. He didn't get any money. They pretended that they didn't know him. It's sort of like the Henry IV part two, when now Prince Hal has become Henry. And he sees his old friend Falstaff. And he says, "I know thee not, old man." It's a chilling moment in Shakespeare.
Right.
And it's similar here to CIA and George de Moorenschild.
So why didn't he spill the beans?
He died. And actually, this is very interesting. I'm glad you raised that, Bonnie, because at the very day before his death, George de Moorenschild arrives in Florida. And who's living in Palm Beach now? Joseph F. Dreyer, Jr., whom he had known in Haiti. And he calls Dreyer and he says, "I have something I want to talk to you about." Now, Dreyer, I haven't even gone into Dreyer yet, but he's an enormously well-connected person. He was in Marine Intelligence. He was, in the highest reaches of the American government and American business. And Dreyer, charming man, wonderful man. He lives in Palm Beach, out down there. And he said, so de Moorenschild says, "Come and can we have lunch today?" And Dreyer was busy, and so he said, let's have lunch tomorrow. And they make a date to have lunch at the house where de Morenschild was staying. Well, that was the day that George de Morenschild was shot and killed. And Joe Dreyer will tell you to this day that he doesn't believe, you know, people say, oh, George de Morenschild killed himself. But in fact, there were no bullets for this gun that was in the house, the maid heard a car drive away. And he had made that date with Dreyer for the next day, which suggests that he had no intention of ending his life.
But the coroner ruled it a suicide.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're speaking with Professor Dr. Joan Mellon of Temple University. We're talking about her latest book, Our Man in Haiti. Before we break, Joan Mellon, is there a website associated with you and the book?
Yes, I have a website. It's www.joanmellon.com. And, of course, you can get the book on Amazon.com quite easily.
Well, let's take that break. We'll be back with more.
And Topical Currents continues in just a moment on South Florida's NPR News Station, 91.3 WLRN and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM.
Back by popular demand, The Sandaland Diaries, the gleeful Christmas rant by David Sedaris, master American satirist, features audience favorite Michael McKeever in this hilarious, critically acclaimed holiday hit. Opening in Boca Raton's Meisner Park on December 13th. Tickets at 866-811-4111. That's 866-811-4111 or paradeproductions.org. The Sandaland Diaries, a delightfully twisted grown-up holiday treat. Hello, it's Bonnie Berman. Join us for Tuesday's Topical Currents when we discuss the book, Conversation Transformation, Recognize and Overcome the Six Most Destructive Communication Patterns. Bad conversations tend to repeat themselves, and what you say matters less than how you say it. A little care and practice can make your conversations more meaningful and rewarding. Tune in to Topical Currents Tuesday at 1 o'clock. And welcome back to Topical Currents, Monday edition. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're visiting with Dr. Joan Mellon. Her latest book is Our Man in Haiti, George de Morenschild and the CIA in the Nightmare Republic. If you want to join in the conversation, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576. It looks like we have a full board already, so won't take any more calls. Professor Mellon, I wanted to ask you why you likened the war on terror to the war to the Cold War.
Well, it's led to so many changes in our society. It's led to this Patriot Act, which deprives us of some of our First Amendment rights. It's led to a president who has targeted individuals, American citizens who never committed a crime, for assassination, the current president. It has a Homeland Security that never existed before, the TSA, where humiliations at the airport occur on a daily basis. It has weakened our freedoms and all in the name of the fight against terrorism. So I would say that just as the Cold War led to a military buildup and buildup of atomic testing and all that, and we get the same thing here.
But there was a threat to our national security, though, on 9/11.
Well, for example, look at the Iraq War that resulted. And these were enormously profitable for Halliburton. Right. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. And that was used as an excuse for us to go to war. And then soon Iraq follows with Afghanistan. There was no al-Qaeda in Afghanistan by the time we start. Obama increased his surge there. And now we're in other countries, have nothing to do with it seems to me that permanent war is the result of the incident. I'm not sure about 9/11. There are so many questions about it. I don't know what happened. I do know what happened in the Kennedy assassination. I don't know what happened. But look, the results seem to be spiraling out of control. And I think the rule of law that we have always believed in and is really the hallmark of this country is not as strong as it was. And the rights of citizens, the rights of people to habeas corpus, to trials, we've had a great loss in our freedoms coming from this. So it looks to me like whatever happened, it's been used as a pretext.
Right.
And we'll take another caller. This is Larry. He's in Miami. Hello, Larry.
Hi, Doctor. Thank you for being on WLRN. I appreciate your contribution, keeping the public informed. I was curious, as I was driving down the highway, I turned into my favorite program and suddenly realized, oh, don't touch that dial. But I have a very simple question. Based on your research at the archives, would you suspect the CIA's intervention with a financial collapse? I'll take the answer off the line. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wish I knew the answer to that. I think the financial collapse is a result of the endless wars. Enormous amount of money that's being spent on a daily basis in wars that get the United States nothing. We get no advantage from it. Our country is impoverished. We have the infrastructures falling apart, and we can't afford to maintain these wars, and yet we have military presence in many, I mean, I don't know how many countries, but it's many. And dozens, maybe. And I think that there's very few people are willing to say that on television or, you know, even cable television. But I think that that plays a large part in why we're... The same thing happened to the Soviet Union, didn't it? When they started military buildup, they couldn't afford it. The people had nothing to eat. And pretty soon the whole system collapsed.
And another and yeah, another caller, this is Anne in Fort Lauderdale. Hello, Anne.
Hi. Hi, Doctor. I'm going to definitely read your book. It sounds very interesting. I remember years ago when I was younger hearing this saying that the CIA is the private army of the Fortune 500. And I also wondered, I know you're discussing their involvement in Haiti, but when you write your book on Cuba, a lot of people don't realize that that there were CIA operatives linked to anti-Castro terrorists that introduced the African swine virus into the pulp production in Cuba that almost wiped out their entire pork production that is a Cuban staple in their diet. I was wondering if you could discuss that.
I don't know really directly about that, but my book about Cuba is coming out on February 1st, and it's called The Great Game in Cuba. And The Great Game is a locution that is used in Britain to describe the intelligence services. And it's used by John le Carré in his book Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. And so you could see this, because I really wanted to do this. Some friend of mine said it's my Caribbean period. I wanted to show how CIA really interested in removing Fidel Castro? So that's the question at the heart of that book. I don't know about the particular incident, but I do know, of course, CIA was ubiquitous in Cuba, both before the Castro Revolution and after. I don't think CIA did anybody, I can't see that they've done anybody any good, and many people, Cuban people who, wanted a more democratic Cuba, if I may say that, didn't find any help from CIA.
Getting back to Haiti, how do you see political events there today?
On the cover of my book, I found this painting of Haitian people protesting with picket signs, Vive la Liberté, and so forth. And I like to say, and I know there have been incidents in Haiti in the last year or so where people have gone out and demonstrated, you know, just very simply, quietly asking for what they're not getting. And then I see the answer to the question of how to help Haiti, the people themselves taking the initiative, people not accepting the status quo, people not looking for help where it's not going to come, and taking the country back for themselves. Nobody else. They don't need anybody else.
And we'll take another caller. This is Miguel in Miami. We're short on time, Miguel. Go ahead.
Hey. Hi, how are you? No, I just wanted to make a quick comment. I tuned in precisely when the doctor was saying that she feels there was a shadow government, because precisely the same feeling that I have, the presidents, I don't feel that they are really in 100% control of the country. And take, for example, Obama. He ran on the platform that he was going to close Guantanamo, and he actually made an event where he signed closing Guantanamo, and nothing happened. So I really feel that the last president in this country we had was John F. Kennedy, and they killed him.
I agree with that. Miguel, absolutely. And a friend of mine said to me this, John F. Kennedy was the last president who thought he could take power.
Exactly.
I agree with that.
It's sad, because the only way that I feel that we are going to get rid of this thing is for people to really stop taking this as face value and just go out on the street and try to change this, because this is going to get worse if we let it go through.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
Okay, thanks for your call, Miguel.
Thank you.
So, tell me very quickly, Joan Mellon, how this intrigue wrapped up with De Morenschild.
Well, De Morenschild died, and as you said, it was ruled a suicide, and we never, the truth has never really come out. And I think I have a little bit of the truth here in Our Man in Haiti with Joe Dreyer, and I have another part of the truth in the addendum about the Hunts, because there I show how CIA planted Paul Rothermel as security chief for Hunt, and his job really was to implicate Hunt in the Kennedy assassination. All I can say is the more we talk, I'm delighted to be on NPR to be able to express these views. And I really want to thank Joseph and Bonnie for having me on.
Well, thank you
so much.
We've been speaking with Dr. Joan Mellon. Her latest book is Our Man in Haiti. And thanks for listening this hour. Apologies to the callers we couldn't get on the air. The Topical Currents producer is Richard Ive, technical direction by Caroline Brader Watts. And Paul Leary is online producer. Find author and book links, such as today's, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like if you will. We have free audio archives and digital downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. Tomorrow's program is about conversation and how to recognize destructive communication patterns. We'll have strategies for success. And to the calendar, on this day in 1894, 117 years ago, the birth of conductor Arthur Fiedler in Boston. He first took the Boston Pops baton in 1930 and led it for 50 years. Of course, John Williams was his successor. And on this day in 1989, 23 years ago, the animated Simpsons series begins on Fox TV. It's the longest-running American primetime scripted television series with 27 Emmy Awards and a Peabody. Time magazine called it the 20th century's best TV series. Conan O'Brien was once on the writing team. One more while we remember Coach Kevin Lockery and your Miami Heat. On this day in 1991, 21 years ago, the Heat loses the most lopsided game in NBA history, 148-80 to the Cleveland Cavaliers. 68-point losers. Oddly, the Heat make the playoffs for the first time in their fourth season. And we leave with a line from the Simpsons' Springfield Police Chief Wiggum. No. You got the wrong number. This is 912. This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making public radio your companion today. Also with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is 91.3